Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Matthew Holm, cartoonist, Baby Mouse co-creator, who paired up with his longtime best friend to draw on the horrors of the middle school experience. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 307 of the podcast with Matthew Holm. I can't wait to share it with you, but first let me share two reviews I received on iTunes from the All the Wonders podcast. One listener, Amanda D. Allen, writes, "It is so refreshing and energizing to listen to Matthew Winner. His excitement for these creators and love for their books is so genuine, it is infectious." It makes me want to find new ways to seek out and engage with children's literature. The guests that he invites are fantastic. Each one has an inspiring approach and viewpoint. The conversational back and forth creates an intimate setting, allowing me to feel like we are all neighbors and friends celebrating a recent achievement. At the end of each podcast, I wish I could hug and high-five everyone. Amanda, well done. Hugs and high-fives to you for sure. Thank you for those awesome words. And another one from Ovi Nadelku, friend of the podcast, writes, "Matthew Winner is winning. He is the Charlie Rose of picture book author interviews." Ovi, you're ridiculous, and I love it. Thank you so much. Listen, I would love to hear your reviews, hear your thoughts on the podcast. I'd love to read it on air. You're so kind. These reviews help the podcast reach new ears, and that's amazing. So thank you for taking the time to write them. If you write one, I'm going to send you an All the Wonders button, a little orange mini button, smiley face. It's adorable. You'll love it. All you have to do is go on to iTunes, post a comment or rate the podcast, and then just email me at here@allthewonders.com and let me know. And make sure in the email you give me your mailing address, and I'll send you a button anywhere in the U.S. It'll be amazing, I promise. All right, time for today's awesomeness. Matthew Holm is known far and wide in elementary schools as the guy who draws Baby Mouse. The one who draws Squish. He's had a busy decade, and our library shelves are proof. But he's also had another project brewing that recently saw publication, Marvin and the Moths. Is Matt's debut middle grade novel, co-authored with Jonathan Follett, about the first year of middle school and how it can be the worst, absolute worst. And then you can realize that the squatters living in the attic of your neighbor's row home are giant moths that can talk. Yep, it's that kind of book. And I bet you're already picturing exactly the kid you need to hand this to. My kind of kid. Here's episode number 307 of the podcast with Matthew Holm. Welcome to the podcast, Matt Holm. I'm glad that we're now finally talking on record.
Thanks for having me.
It's been so exciting to talk to you. And then, again, that moment always happens with me where I'm like, oh, we should probably hit record. So, Matt, welcome.
Yes.
And thank you. I told Jenny when she was on a couple months ago the same sentiment. But thank you for taking up so much space on our library shelves and also in the desks of all of our classrooms, because not only is Baby Mouse a presence in our library, but during the school year, Baby Mouse is not on the shelves of our library. She is out with the children. So thank you for that, for all that you have done to contribute to raising readers and all that. And plus, my God, you and your sister doing Sunny Side Up was, I talked and talked about that book. It's wonderful. So, okay, Love Fest, here we are.
Awesome.
Already, thanks. That didn't take long. There we are. We're already in the Love Fest portion of the podcast. Why don't we just continue it and talk about Marvin and the Moths, because you have a novel out, and I'm going to save my nerding out over it to just give you a chance to talk and share with the people listening your, I don't know, synopsis of Marvin and the Moths.
So, Marvin and the Moths is a book I wrote with my best friend since middle school, and it's a book that takes place in middle school. So we drew on a lot of the horrors of our own childhood middle school experience, and then projected them forward into a very strange and bizarre way. Basically, what happens is young Marvin Watson, his baby brother is born. As you know, sort of a late addition to the family, and they're in a small, you know, row home, and there's no room to have the baby and Marvin, and you know, given an extra room for a nursery. So Marvin's parents decide that he should move up to the attic, but it's not like, you know, a finished attic. It's not a nice bonus room with like an air hockey table or something. It's a completely unfinished attic full of cobwebs and boxes and spiders and you know, moth-eaten clothes and everything else. And while he's up there, you know, being miserable about his life, he's also meanwhile starting sixth grade, and he has different kinds of misery there. And it all converges when he discovers that there are giant mutant moths who are very surly and sarcastic living in one of the neighboring attics of his townhouse complex. And like, it's basically an old building, so all the attics are sort of like run into each other, and the, you know, the construction wasn't very careful, so there's holes in the wall and stuff. And so he winds up going through and discovering them and sort of befriending them, but they're also very very rude and belittle him often. So they're highly intelligent and sort of highly unreliable at the same time. And then all of this is taking place while he's trying to deal with things at school. And there is a mysterious menace stalking his town, which is called Butcherville, because he lives in a company town, and the company, Pork Loaf International, their primary product is the pork loaf log roll, which is a processed meat food-like product. And they have an entire range of products that go along with it. But, you know, they started off with a classic processed meat product. And, yeah, so the whole town is geared around this, and they eat it all the time. But meanwhile, there's a mysterious menace that's stalking through the shadows and leading to a series of animal disappearances that that culminate in a crisis eventually.
Yes. Let me just first say that here's the magic of reading and suspending disbelief. When I was reading about Butcherville, I was like, this is a place? This is crazy. And they have roads like Butt Avenue or whatever it was called, Butt Boulevard.
Butt Boulevard, one lane. You know.
But it was that moment
those where Peachtree names and down in Atlanta, you know, yes, you've got names. Yes. That's a
well, to be brought into this place where we're already establishing, like, look, these people drink pork punch. They are like, the whole town has decided to embrace the theme of, you know, the main product that they produce. It was just fantastic to be dropped into that, and it did remind me of a lot of stuff that I read growing up, a lot of stuff, let's be more honest, a lot of stuff that I watched growing up. But, I wasn't, I've said it before on here, but just to be frank with you, I wasn't quite a reader growing up. I did read comics, but, you know, maybe like you too, I was told that that wasn't reading. So in that way, I didn't really read growing up until I maybe found Michael Crichton and suddenly was reading Jurassic Park in like late middle school.
But, yeah, I always find that interesting. People, see, we were personally never told that comics weren't reading at home. I've been told that a lot as an adult, but at home I was never told that. My dad was a huge comics fan, and I'm the youngest out of five kids, so all of my brothers had been collecting comic books and comic strip collections for years, and my mom would give us, you know, comics in our stocking, or, you know, when we're going to go on a long trip, we'd get some comic books to, you know, keep us quiet. And yeah, so we were always reading comics and reading kind of everything else too, because when you had that many people in the house over that many years, the books start to pile up after a while.
Oh,
so
yeah, yeah.
So I was never told what to read or what not to read. And so I just kind of would pick and choose, and there'd be days when I wanted to read comics, there'd be days when I wanted to read about the space program, there'd be days when I wanted to you know, read Dr. Seuss again, even if I was like 14 or something. So yeah, I was never told when what was okay for my age and what was not okay,
I got my dose from teachers. A little bit from teachers that's what it was. That no, this is what you should be reading. Which I should say in one part is why I don't think I even read it though, but why I was handed or checked out a copy of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because remember they used to have those like glorious illustrations on the front that looked like an Atari game.
Yes. Yep.
So I remember checking that out, and my parents were, I didn't transition from picture books with them. And I think like to their credit, they just, when they grew up, that wasn't what they were reading. They weren't reading, you know, middle grade books or whatever.
No.
But, yeah. But I do remember reading the Funnies with my dad, and then also that they had like Time Life books that I would like obsess over looking at stuff. So I think it's fair to say my dad in particular really raised me on a heavy dose of like Discovery Channel, Smithsonian type learning. So that served me well. But but to be able to come back and have and then Ninja Turtles. So there's that.
Yes, of course.
So
yeah.
To be able to come back now as an adult and to be reading as if I was younger and just enjoying it, and also having a son and being able to enjoy stuff with him now too. It's cool to have books like this and to think like, yes, there are my younger self. I am teaching my younger self right now. And here is a book that I would be handing to said child. So it's just great. I mean, your book is bizarre, Matt, and it's hilarious. And it's just weird. And it's like, really? I mean, this is, you now have entered the hallowed grounds of I'm recommending Marvin to kids the same way that I recommend Whales on Stilts. You know, Whales on Stilts, like that one of those, again, like this book is insane. I'm grateful that you created it. And even cooler to know that like you wrote it with your middle grade best friend, your middle school best friend, and that, I mean, I have to feel like you're tapping back into your childhood writing this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's been almost 30 years that we've known each other now. And so we have shared experiences going way, 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 way back. And especially, you know, a lot of the early traumas that forged our friendship in middle school find their echoes in this book. So.
Oh, no. So there were like did you say you're the youngest? Are you the youngest in the family?
I'm the youngest. Yep.
Oh, so you did not have Baby Harry experiences, but you potentially were Baby Harry to.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was Squeak in Jenny's World. You know, I'm Baby Teddy in Sunnyside Up. Yeah, I'm the annoying little brother. Yeah, no. John had a younger sister. My co-author John Follett. So he was pulling a lot of that sort of stuff. You know, some of it was us. Some things come out of mechanics of writing. You know, we're like, we know we want Marvin to end up in the attic. How does that happen exactly? And then we start thinking about it. And then you start going back And sometimes it's just like, oh, well, you know, if there's a new baby, then he might have to, you know, get out of his room. Like, that's a little ridiculous, but it's semi-plausible. We're like, okay, we could do that. And then we start, you know, then you start mining for the experience of, you know, what is it like having a screaming baby brother in the house, or, you know, going from being the only child, which John was, to no longer being the only child. You know, it happened. His sister is closer in age than baby Harry and Marvin are. But, it's still, you know, you still remember those things very deeply, I think.
Yeah, and I like, too, that you're describing that writing process that I hear about often, which is that you start with a scenario, and then you just start asking questions, and that's how the story comes out, by just asking questions.
That is really it, yeah. Everyone's like, you don't tell a story. You have to find it. You keep asking yourself, is this what he would do? Is this what would happen next? What if this happened? And with two people, you're actually asking those questions. You're not just asking them of yourself or of the page as you're writing it out. We're actually asking them back and forth. And so our writing sessions are, you know, a lot of it is just long discussion and question and answer, and us thinking like, does that make sense? Or no, that doesn't work. What about this? You know, I don't think the character would be quite like that. I think they might be like more like this. And so you're feeling it out by just asking question after question after question. And then we'll sit down and actually just have a long writing session and power through actually getting words on the page. But yeah, there's a lot of sort of like research, investigation you have to do in your own brain essentially beforehand.
Well, and I feel like too, especially doing it with a co-author, you and John then, by asking these questions to one another, also each fully realize your world so that you're able to answer these questions of one another. You're able to be on the same page when you're writing down, literally be on the same page.
Right. And you're also, you know, you get to, which is, you know, what happens whenever you have an editor look at your work or anything else, but you immediately have another brain looking at it and listening to it and seeing if it makes sense or not. Which if you're just writing by yourself in a vacuum, things that seem obvious to you may be completely non-obvious to someone from the outside. And you're like, oh, I thought I explained that. Like, no, you didn't explain that at all. I'm like, oh, okay, I got to go back and fix that, you know, so.
So for you and John, how do you write? Do you actually, like, are you both, like, in the same, I don't know, Google Doc or something?
It is. It's totally.
Editing each other's sentences? Or
yes.
Yeah.
So what we'll do is, when we first started out, we wrote, I lived in upstate New York, John lives in Boston, and I would drive up to his place for the weekend and we'd just do these marathon writing sessions where we'd just sit and work for many hours in both, you know, looking at the same computer screen. And then when I moved to Portland, we started working long distance. We'd call each other up on the phone, and Google Docs had just come out about that time. And we realized when you open it up and you start typing, you can see whatever the other person is typing pretty much live.
Right.
And so basically usually I'll be the one who's typing, who's driving. And John is, essentially John comes up with a lot of the crazier ideas. And then I'll act as sort of like on the spot editor, and either just a lot of times I'm just desperately trying to keep up and type down saying, and then sometimes I'm like, I don't think that's working, you know, maybe we should try something else, and then John will throw something else out. John, his mom is a piano teacher, and so he grew up learning to play the piano and then playing jazz piano through high school and into college and everything.
So he's hardwired for improvisation.
Yes, he improvs all the time, and he has, you know, he can have, he's funny, he's extremely detail oriented. You know, very obsessive about getting everything perfect when he's like shipping a product, but he's also very much about capturing that sort of jazz spirit of like, you know, this is spontaneous, we got to do this and get it down, and then he's sort of like, you know, onto the next thing immediately, onto the next idea, and let's get that down too. So, but yeah, so we'll riff, I'll type, we'll go back and read stuff, and then we'll outline, you know, huge chunks of where the story is going to go so that we know kind of what blanks we have to fill in. And then you have to be willing to, you know, know when the ideas that you're coming up with live, that you're improvising, or the way the characters are going are better than whatever you had planned out before, and then you have to steer off the road, basically.
When you have to listen to the story instead of listening to what your plan was.
Yeah, exactly. I think it always helps to have the outline so you know where you're going roughly. You know how you might get there, and it'll help you plan some of the more dramatic moments and things. But then things come up that will totally surprise you, and you'll be you'll say, wow, that's better than what I thought of, you know, several months ago. So I should be working on that now and do that. So yeah, you have to trust your, you know, yes, as you're listening to what you're reading out loud to yourself, like, oh, that's better than whatever this thing is on paper. And it's safe for me to ignore that outline part.
And I feel like not only to have John bring on the crazy, because there's so much good crazy in this book, yes, but also to have someone else with you to help with the humor. So yes, for me, like, I think about humor, I feel like, maybe, hopefully for other people, maybe I hope I'm not alone in this, but I feel like humor is an abstract thing to think about. How do you write it? How do you write it and maintain humor after editing, after putting it on paper, after the work that has to go through? But to have someone else to go, is this funny? Am I making you laugh when I'm coming up with this idea? Am I entertaining you?
Yeah, that's part of why we do what we do with this is, you know, we have never laughed harder than when we were working on this, and our wives would be in the other room and just be like, oh my God, what is happening in there? Because they were so raucous and ridiculous, just busting up laughing. And you know, it's that, you know, yes, as you're reading the joke the 18th time when you're editing, you're like, okay, that's funny. But every now and then you'll be reading through and you're like, yes, I know that's coming. And then you just forgot that you had written something and it'll just catch you and you'll start laughing again. So that's good. And yeah, it's, and I think humor is definitely a social function, and it's hard to do that completely on your own. You always at least have to have an imaginary person who you're trying to bust up, you know? So if you have a live one, it's a lot easier.
That's right. Well, I like that from the very first chapter, this book sort of tells you who it is. I like that you maintain that consistently. I like that we get into the action. I like that we are thrown into middle school with, first off, Marvin has such a loving, positive attitude when, like, on page one, and then it just falls apart for the man. I mean, like, poor guy. And to have, what is it? The phrase that I never lost was shower kraut, I think.
Shower kraut, yeah.
I was like, that's awful. Poor Marvin. But to have that play out, to have this notion that you have a cousin in school, so things will all be better. There's someone that you know, and have it just be like the most awful person. there were just things that were established so early on that I felt like we met Marvin, and then you just piled on so many problems for him that, yes, it made it for the reader, for us to feel like something has to go right for this boy, please. And that, to raise the stakes that way, I feel like in the beginning was just a lot of fun, because you're laughing at how terrible a kid's life is going. I mean, for me, going like, God, yeah, you know what? In middle school, it was one awful thing after another.
Oh, yeah.
And it all felt like the worst thing ever that was being publicized on all the local television stations, even though really it was just whoever saw it in gym class. But it wasn't whoever saw it in gym class, because by lunchtime everyone had known about it.
Yep. And yeah, you forget that it keeps coming at you some days when you're in middle school, especially. I mean, now that we're grown-ups, we have different concerns and cares and different fears of embarrassment, but the embarrassment comes fast and furious when you're in middle school, you know, in part because people are cruel and in part because you don't know how to behave yet. You know, you haven't learned any of that yet. And so you make things so much worse for yourself than they ought to be. You know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, Marvin, all this terrible stuff is happening to him. Like, that's, which is sort of like the thing I always joke about, like with Baby Mouse. You know, we have this beautiful, lovable character who's so sweet, and then we do terrible, terrible things to her all the time. You know, we have all this misfortune happen to her. You know, but that's what you do to your characters. You make bad things happen to them. But Marvin, you know, he's as much as he's, you know, the world is coming at him. He's kind of a jerk too, you know. He's not always the most understanding. He's sort of rude to his new potential friends Fatima and Lee, and you know, he comes around, but he's, you know, he's not flawless at all, and a lot of his problems are made worse by his own actions.
That's true. There is that. I mean, again, like I'm always thinking, like, what is the reader going to see in this? And to see that sometimes we bring it on ourselves.
Yep.
There's something to be said for that. So, okay, you've brought it up twice now, so I have to know. Middle school. How was middle school for you? Was it like the quintessential everyone hates middle school? It's just something you have to endure, or was it all right for you?
Oh, no, it was miserable. I had a terrible, terrible time. I had a really great time in elementary school through fourth grade. Fifth grade, they closed my school. Because the district, you know, the kid population was shrinking. They, of course, reopened it like 3 years later or, you know, 5 years later or something. And then added more schools because there were even more kids being born. But at the time, they closed my school and one other school in the district. And so I got a fifth grade I spent in a different school in our district. And that was very weird and awkward. But most of the, you know, the kids who were from my school went over there, too. So I knew like at least half the people that were there. So I'm like, okay, it's not so bad. It's a little disordered. But then I got to middle school, and man, it was just like everything completely changed. Like all the rules were off. You know, everyone who was your friend was no longer your friend. There were, you know, things like were sort of like awkward through sixth grade. And then in seventh grade, I feel like they were coming back together. And I had, you know, made a bunch of friends, or, you know, I had the same friends from elementary school that I'd been friends and would play soccer with at recess and everything. And I was, you know, sitting at the lunch table. And then one day I go to sit at the lunch table and there's no room for me because I've been kicked out of the lunch table. And so, yeah, so all of the people who I thought were my friends are no longer my friends. And John, he used to live in Connecticut. And so his family moved down when we were in seventh grade. And so I knew him vaguely through our classes together, but didn't really get to know him that well. And then when that day when I was kicked out of the lunch table, I was just sort of wandering around in shock. He said, "Oh, yeah, why don't you come sit over here?" You know, at his table where, you know, there was no one sitting because no one liked John at that point either because he was new and John did have a talent in his youth for saying terrible things to people, saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. and I'm sure I seem to remember on a number of occasions he was complaining because he came from a more urban area where he could like skateboard everywhere. He had all these friends around. He was like class president. And then he moved to our place, which was in the sticks compared to where he was. And he didn't know anybody. You know, you had to drive everywhere if you wanted to go do anything or see anybody. He didn't know anyone yet. And he's just like, "Oh, this place sucks. My old home was better," which is, you know, what everyone who moves in the middle of school always has to say, you know, because you hate where you've just moved to. No one's like, "This is amazing." You know, maybe that's if you moved to Hawaii or something, you're like, it's like, "Forget home. I'm staying here," you know. But yeah, usually it's very upsetting and you really wish you were back where you were. And if you vocalize that, then people, you know, people take it to heart. So John didn't have too many friends then either. And, but he took me in, you know, shelter from the storm, which was great. And so we became friends after that. And and then things sort of smoothed out after that. I had a much smaller circle of friends. All of my extremely, nerdy, you know, academically gifted friends. So we were all the nerds and, you know, we did well in class, but we didn't do all the sports everyone did. And, you know, we never went to parties. Instead, we sat around and made up weird stories and drew comics and, you know, formed a rock band and that sort of stuff. So
nice. Yeah. My nerdy friends and I, we just talked endlessly about Nintendo. I'm there with you. Just same stuff, different story.
Yeah, we came up in that weird video game gap because Nintendo was starting, but it wasn't really huge. Yeah. I think it started like a couple years after I would have been in the right age bracket so for
I hit
it.
I hit the sweet spot for it. I was born in 81, and it was just like just the right time.
Yeah, see, we had Atari in my youth, but you know that only went so far, and then it died, and then we're like, well, there's nothing else. That's the end of it. And you know, we would play like games on the PC and stuff, but they were really sad, you know, and usually in black and white because you couldn't afford a color monitor for your computer.
But I had older friends like you would have been that age that got me into a lot of comics because of my age being that that's when the X-Men cartoon hit.
Right.
And so that was a big deal. Then I was like, comics, let's go. Let's do this. And then there were people that were a couple years older than me that showed me cool stuff that introduced me to stuff that was, yeah, that was more in the universe for that. For me, it was just Marvel. But I remember finding out about Deadpool, and I remember finding out about, I don't know, Bishop and different people, and just being like, this is awesome.
Yeah, John actually introduced me to a lot of comics and stuff that I hadn't gotten into before. Like, I was huge into, like, I've probably read, I don't know, 85% of the Peanuts comics that were published from like 1950 up through, you know, 1990 or something. Like,
nice. Wow. Right,
like I was just like, we had collections going through the entire, like from the first collection in the 50s when my eldest brother was reading them as a kid, you know, through the 60s and through the 70s and into the 80s. And so I was steeped in that and in all of the newspaper comics, in Garfield, in Calvin and Hobbes, in Bloom County, all that stuff, you know, Far Side. And so I was consumed with that. But John, he was up in, when he was up in Connecticut, he had run into at a local comic book convention, Eastman and Laird, who created Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Cause they were self-publishing at that point. Their comics were just black and white. They hadn't, you know, gone big time and had the cartoon and everything on TV. So he got some of the early ones and, introduced me to those. And that was sort of mind-blowing because I'm like, oh, it's just like a couple of guys. And they basically just drew this whole comic themselves and then published it.
And published,
you know, they didn't. Yeah, you know, they just, I'm like, you could do that? Like, and so that really, you know, nowadays, of course, you can put anything online and then it's immediately available to the entire world. But the idea that you could make a comic and people might be able to see it, not just, you know, your friends in school or something, was mind-blowing. And John also... He also had one of his friends who, in sixth grade, had a comic strip that was syndicated in one of the local newspapers up there.
What? In sixth grade? Shoot.
Yeah, I'm like, how is that possible? And so he was showing it to me. I'm like, wow. I'm like, oh, maybe I could do that. And so that's what really started me drawing my first, like, actual comic, like, formal comic strips, some of my early comic strips. I'm like, I could do that. And so I started like focusing on like making real comic strips in with consistent borders and panels and size and characters and everything. So,
well, and you say that notion of I can do that is still what carries on today, that you see, it's almost like seeing somebody else do it gives you the permission to try, gives you the sense that it's okay to make this thing. So even though now kids have like access to being able to publish more easily, they're seeing things like my kid's watching stuff on YouTube and has asked me in the past for us to make a video of him teaching people how to put together Lego, for example.
Right.
And he's called me his assistant. My assistant is going to hand me stuff. But it's that, like, you're studying kids going, oh, I could see myself doing that.
Yeah,
but to have, I mean, I love that notion that to see these comics and to go like, oh, so you can just make this yourself. So
right.
I could do that. it's just, I mean, it just is something special that it's that universal that we all sort of have moments like that. We're just watching someone. I mean, for God's sakes, it's like watching somebody ride a bike and you're like, oh. So, like, it's possible to make that balance?
Right. That's like, a that thing? Seems, that's ridiculous. How did you know that?
That's right. It's not through magic. It's not just me going down a really steep hill.
Well, that's one of the things I hope, you know, with all of the authors doing school visits and things nowadays. Because when I was a kid, we never had an author come to my school. We had, like, you know, we had, like, the local... you know, the local like youth, you know, like community theater group do something.
Yeah.
And we had like the local sheriff or the state trooper would come and talk to us, or the firefighters, you know, something like that. But like authors we never heard from. We never knew where these books came from other than just the library. They just sort of appeared. You never really thought about who the people were that were making them, you know, except for like Dr. Seuss, who seemed like a personality of some kind.
Yeah, and Shel Silverstein. Shel Silverstein, right, exactly. Had that horrifying picture on the back of the
book. Yes. I'm like, who's that bald guy? What's going on exactly?
This is amazing.
And so, yeah, so you never thought that it was like a real human being doing a real job, and that this was therefore something you could do. So like that was like when, you know, I always wanted to make, I really wanted to make newspaper comics even into high school. But there was never any conception of really how that would happen. There's no, you know, comics at that point. There was no comics degree in college. You know, now there are comics colleges with degrees and everything. But there was no clear path on how you would go and get syndicated, or how you would get the necessary skills or make the connections or any of that sort of stuff. And same thing with publishing books. There's no, I didn't have any idea of how you could make a living doing that. You know, my parents were in the Navy, and then they, you know, did medicine. And so they had no clue about any of this creative stuff, like how you could possibly do a career in that. You know, my dad had basically two jobs in his life. You know, he entered the Navy, retired from the Navy, you know, just started, went and joined a private practice, and then retired from that. And that was it. So he didn't really understand this whole, like, you're a freelancer, you got to come up with these crazy ideas and then convince some publisher to publish them. And like, you'll get money. How? Like, how is this going to happen? Like, don't you want, like, you know, to eat and things like that? So, yeah. So it seemed really inexplicable. So I hope at the very least kids, you know, seeing more authors going around live and of course, yeah, reading the books, learning more about them, actually encourages them to try it too and see that it's possible.
I think they live in a perfect time to be able to do that. The fact that even if an author isn't able to make it to your school, that we're able to Skype with other people and to see experiences that way, and to, there's just so much there. It's going to be neat to see in, you know, 10, 20 years what they produce, because it'll be they're going to create the future for us. It's cool.
Yep.
Hey, so what other stuff are you working on now? Are you and John working on more stories with Marvin?
We have some more ideas in the works. We don't have anything. We don't have anything lined up yet with Marvin, though. We have plotted out several more book ideas with Marvin in his little universe. So we know where the story will go if we're given the green light.
Yeah,
haven't yet been given the green light, and we're working on some other ideas and pitching them around to see if anyone will bite on that. So, and a lot of it's just me trying to find time into my schedule now. Like Marvin took 10 years to finish.
Whoa!
Yeah, because A, we were doing it sort of long distance and part time, and B, I, you know, did 20 Baby Mouse books and 8 Squish books in that period of time.
In that period of time, yeah.
and John had 2 kids, so he didn't have a lot of free time, you know. So we were going pretty strong there for a while, and then we got like just like crushed when both of his kids were around, and I was deep into making 2 Baby Mouse books and 2 Squish books a year, so we lost like at least two years there. We were like not really working on it at all, and then we, you know, picked up the pieces and got back to work and got it done, and so now we're it's like we think we can work it into our schedules now to do another book, and so we're trying to figure out what the best project would be to do next, and I need to find time to be able to do some sketches, and we need to work up our proposals and all that sort of stuff. So he and I are still plotting and scheming for additional stories. What else am I working on? I just finished doing thumbnail sketches for the sequel to Sunnyside Up. So,
oh, wow, I had no idea. Cool. Yep.
So I'll be finishing inking that over the rest of the year. And yeah, we'll... I'm trying to think what else is going on. We just finished a new Baby Mouse project, which the ARCs, the advanced reader copies, have gone out to people already, I think, where Baby Mouse enters middle school. You know, middle school is a constant time of peril.
I've heard about this. More middle school. Yeah. Let's keep going. More, yes. Bring on the middle school books. Yes.
Yes. Yes. It's called Lights, Camera, Middle School, and it's a new series with Baby Mouse called Baby Mouse Tales from the Locker, where it takes place. She's, you know, entering middle school, And it's more of a hybrid. So it's more like Dork Diaries or Diary of a Wimpy Kid, where it's, you know, a mix of text and comics.
Okay.
So Baby Mouse will be telling her own story in her own voice. And then we'll break in with, you know, illustrations of what's going on and, you know, little lists of things that she's writing and doodling. And then, of course, crazy fantasy sequences where Baby Mouse is still imagining that bizarre things are happening to her, because you got to have that.
No doubt. Well, I'm glad that of all the stuff you're doing too, that you and John are still thinking about more stuff to do together. Cause that's cool. I mean, I love that. I really admire that you've been friends for that long, but also found out that you could make stuff together.
Yeah, that's actually, that's sort of been like a huge part of what our friendship is based on, especially as we, you know, got out of high school and we were just back then you're stuck together because you're like, please a friend, you know, but now we're having to go out of our way to, you know, to maintain friendships as we live in different cities and things. And, but yeah, that working together on projects has always been something that we've done. So, yeah, so it's fun to keep doing that and to finally see something that we've been working on come to fruition.
Well, I love it, Matt Holm. You got a lot of good stuff going on, and I love that you keep reaching out to more readers. And I especially love Marvin and the Moths. I feel like you wrote a book for me, and I really like that. Coming into it, I know I said this before, but just as a closing, it felt to me like, oh, this is going to be the greatest conversation with Matt, because I know that he lived my childhood, that he has my interest, and that sort of experience that I know, and you know, but that I know that kids go through too, that bonds them to the person that wrote the book, that's a really special thing. So for those kids that this book is just right for, I'm glad that you wrote it, that John wrote it, that it's out there in the world, and I hope that you get many, many great returns from your readers, from the new kids that are going to read this, new audience that'll come in to read this and connect with you. Thanks again for writing it and for sharing it with me.
Sure thing.
All right, so before I let you go, I want to give you the final word and bring it back to those kids and say that tomorrow I'm going to see a library full of children. So, Matt, what message can I bring to them from you?
Well, you know, just like we were talking about, you know, I'm hoping that our authors going around and seeing them inspires them that they can do this sort of stuff themselves in the future. We need them to do that. So I would say to them, you're all important. You're all valuable. And we need each and every one of you and what you're going to do for us in the future. You're going to make amazing things.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Robert Zabuda talks about his newest pop-up books from Candlewick Press, in addition to the thousands of hands that worked to bring them to readers. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.